No Direction and Paizo bring you our Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. Today's episode, The Cutting Room Floor. What didn't make it into the Pathfinder playtest? No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
Hello, everybody. Everybody having a good Gen Con?
Yeah.
Woo! This panel is called The Cutting Room Floor. This is a panel in which the design team for the new version of Pathfinder is going to talk about some of the things that didn't make it into the game. It's kind of a weird panel. We were like, yeah, maybe people want to hear that, and apparently a lot of you do. So we're going to talk to you guys a bit about what didn't make it into the game, and meanwhile, we'll also be talking about some of the things that did, right? You know, we didn't put this in, we put that in instead. So it should be a fun, lighthearted panel. We'll open it up and take some questions toward the end. But to start off, we'll introduce ourselves. Hi, I'm Jason Bowman. I'm the Director of Game Design at Paizo.
And I'm Stephen Radney McFarland, the Senior Designer.
I'm Logan Bonner. I'm a designer.
Mark Seifter, also a designer.
So it shouldn't come as any real surprise that if you spend 3 years working on a game, you go in a lot of different directions, right? There were moments where we designed entire systems and then pulled them back and went, no, this isn't quite right, and tossed it and made something else. I think we'll stay away from just the, like, oh, we decided to go with this math formula instead of that one because I'll put you all to sleep. But we can talk about some of the more interesting things that didn't make it into the game. First of all, how many of you are at least now passingly familiar with the new version of Pathfinder? Oh, good. That helps.
Good.
I have no idea what you're talking about. All of this is new. Oh, all right.
What? There's a playtest.
Yeah, that's right. We just dropped it. Yeah, I had to break that news to somebody yesterday, someone I really admire, and he was like, wait, there's a second edition? And I'm like, yeah, it just came out. Anyway, so...
Who was that?
Ty Frank, one of the guys who writes The Expanse.
Oh.
he was very shocked, and I was very sad. All right. In 3 years, you experiment a lot, right? Designing a game of this magnitude isn't just write down the first thing that comes to mind and send it to the printer. That way lies madness. You don't end up with a good game that way. Well, our methodology is design, test, design, test, redesign, test, redesign, test, refine, test. It's constant phases of designing and testing. And as a result, you end up with a lot of bits and pieces left over. I'm going to start by talking about one of the really big ones that didn't make it into the book, and it nearly did. It was this close, but we just didn't have a lot of space for it. And we'll probably just kind of go round robin on these with design things that we all did. For me, my biggest thing that ended up not making it into the book was an entire system called Relics. Relics were magic items that you got when you were relatively low level, and they scale up with you in power as you grow in character power. I was really excited for this system. I really wanted to make it work. I was redesigning how some of the most classic items in the game worked, like the Flame Tongue starts as just a sword that's warm to the touch when you first pick it up. And then at some point in time in the future, you fully unlock its power and it bursts into flames. And it was really kind of cool. It was a fun way to experience some of these items. It also ended up being like 14 pages before I even started fleshing out, because it was basically like building a whole new character in an item form. And it got redesigned like 3 different times, and eventually it ended up looking a lot like how you build characters. Like, you choose abilities that get slotted into the item. Really, really fun, really, really cool, but it was just way too big. Sometimes when you're designing things like this, you have to look at the page count of the book and just go, I don't have room for this anymore. I just can't make this fit. This is also one of those systems that I think we're probably going to find a way to squeeze into one of the books in the future, maybe even for a playtest coming up later on in the cycle, but we'll see.
Are there also some echoes of some of that design work in some of the existing items, like some of the classic items that we had kind of done relic versions of? Some of those abilities, when we cut the system, we're like, well, but we could still have that on like a greater Cloak of Elvenkind or whatever.
Yeah.
So a few of those things kind of stuck around, some of the tidbits from it.
Yeah, you'll notice some of the most kind of classic iconic items of the game all of a sudden have all these extra kind of little bits and bobs. That's because we ported them all back. Because we were like, well, we moved them all into relics. We better move those back. Otherwise, people are going to be like, where the hell's my Cloak of Elvenkind?
Or my Knapsack of Halflingkind. That's a new one.
The Knapsack of Halflingkind. That's right.
It's full of treats and food and also other things.
It's not full of halflings.
I believe the knapsack made it into the book, but the greater version did not.
Oh. That is the one that has halflings. So.
I think that's the one you can jump into the knapsack and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
That one has greater halflings. That's
right, yeah. The Galarian version of the barrel of monkeys.
It's not about height, Jason.
Yes,
that doesn't
is.
Make one greater.
I did.
Judge them by their size.
I am the almighty tallest. for those of you who get that reference, kudos. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. It was a very large, very robust system filled with kind of interesting nooks and crannies. And something people have been asking for a long time, like magic items that scale up with you. And we've kind of taken a shot at these more than once, I think.
We Unchained, have scaling items in Unchained.
Unchained has them. This was a fresh take on it. It wasn't based on Unchained too much. It was us, because we could start wherever we wanted and kind of build it from the ground up.
It was more modular, whereas Unchained, it was like, here's this item. This is exactly what it does when it gets up to particular levels.
Yeah, and our the most recent draft of Relics was a lot more story-based. Like, an item would have a theme, and the GM would kind of slot in things that unlocked in it, and it was kind of more...
Yeah, or possibly give you choices, and when it powered up was kind of up to story moments when that would happen. It wasn't just automatic. It's funny because the whole system grew up right around the same time we were designing Resonance, which is one of the systems that got redesigned like three times throughout this process. And in the early stages, Relics were a big part of the Resonance system because as they grew in power, they took more and more of your Resonance to keep them fully going because that was kind of the cost for making them work. But when we redesigned that system and then the Relics fell out, the whole system changed. So anyway, that's a really exciting system. We're hoping that we'll bring that one to you. Maybe some point in the future, not right now. Obviously, we got plenty of stuff to playtest, but that's just one of the things that just didn't make it. Logan, Mark, you guys got something that didn't make it?
So, some of the stuff for kind of tools for game mastering, we didn't really have space for in the playtest rulebook. That we're hoping to reintroduce some of that for the final core rulebook. But I wrote up a bunch of stuff on like rule, guidelines for like when people have technology at the table and how to use that in your game. A bunch of stuff about like kind of the content of games and a whole bunch of kind of GM advice that we think is important enough that it should be part of the core expression rather than just being kind of in a GM book, so that more people read it. But that we just couldn't fit into the playtest, especially since the playtest is a little more aimed at experienced players rather than like brand new people. It's kind of like not quite as important as getting all the levels of spells in there.
Yeah. There comes a point where you just have to make decisions. Page count is a mess, and thank God none of you ever have to deal with it. It's boring, and it's just like, but you get your editors and your publisher looking at you going, you can't have any more pages. That's it. That's as many as you get. Fit the words in there.
And the warehouse looking at you and saying, we can't ship a book bigger than this.
Yeah.
Chill out.
Yeah, our core rulebook from first edition pushed the boundaries of what we could ship in one box. And they were like, no more pages. Otherwise, we can't ship it. And so it's funny how little decisions like that will then force us to make different decisions about how the game is actually put together, because those limitations are things we have to live with.
Yep.
Mark, what do you got?
Well, I have not that much that was cut for space. I had more that's cut during brainstorming, but during the cut for space section that we're doing now, there were a few rituals that... We just had slightly too many rituals to fit into the space that we had for rituals and spells. So there are a few that aren't in there that were some of the more complicated rituals that are more story rituals that you probably could figure out and that you don't use all the time, like imprisonment. It now sort of has combined with the binding spell as well, which is sort of the first ritual ever in Pathfinder. Even though it wasn't called a ritual, it totally had secondary casters and it took a long time and all this weird stuff happened during it. So it has like all those put them in a gem, put them to sleep, chain them up, or the classic oubliette where you just stick them in the center of the earth. And then the freedom spell, which is to get them out of imprisonment or other similar sticky situations, is also a ritual that was cut because if you don't have one, then you don't have the other. There may have been another ritual or two that were cut, but those are the two that I remember because imprisonment's super long because it has all those kinds of imprisonment.
We needed to lose a spread, and that was like, spread is two pages, and that was most of one.
Yeah. And rituals are one where it's like, we really did a lot, especially Mark did a lot of kind of like surveying around the office, like, okay, we only have room for these. Which of these are less important? You know, like creating undead is going to not be as important as resurrecting someone for real.
Right. So, and simulacrum is not as important as awakening an animal. And then I collated what everybody thought on the design team and beyond of the people that I asked and put in the most important ones in order and then tried to cut the ones that were least important of those when we ran out of space. Yeah.
Steven, you got anything you want to add to this this bit of things that didn't make it?
A lot of really dorky stuff.
That's what these people are clearly here to hear about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I went down a couple of what I consider fun but tedious rabbit holes of like, oh, let's take a look at the gem charts from the beginning and talk about that and gem crafting and everything else. And I did a lot of work on that that it was eventually like, yeah, this is cool. It might end up later in the book. And, you know, and it involved me making sure that all of these names and the descriptions of the gems were correct with, you know, gem books from Smithsonian and stuff like that. And I like that kind of dorky nonsense.
It's really cool, actually, how, like, we... Like, there was a lot of research done on some of the dorkier parts of the game to make some of these things work a little bit more... And I know this is a game, but accurately. Like... You know, shields just providing an AC bonus, yeah, and that makes some sense. But now you can actually use them to absorb damage like they were actually used for.
Right. At least on my side, a lot of that came out from watching Vikings, which I think that show does a really good job of showing how at least, you know, the Norse use their shields. And I was like, God, well, you could do all sorts of crazy crap with shields. I'm going to make rules. You know, and I think those got kind of settled down to you raise your shield and you can block.
Yeah, well, we didn't want to. Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want the game to get too complicated or go down too many dorky rabbit holes. There's a lot of, the snare stuff, the snare rules are a bit more...
Nearly didn't make it at all, but we managed to save them.
Nearly didn't make it at all. There's a lot on the cutting room floor on that, but we put it out there enough to play test and see if people like that system, and I thought it was a good part of the Ranger. What's that? I heard mumbling somewhere.
He's on the cutting room floor.
Soon we will be cutting members of you.
Yeah.
Real nice.
Poisons. There's a lot of poisons in here, and I went through the chart, and not only did I translate all the poisons, but I went and did research to make sure that the real world ones had effects that were more similar to those poisons in the real world. And a good amount of those are in, but, like, you know, trimming that section, it's all like, well, I guess I don't need that many poisons.
Sure our search history is great, because I was the one who had the next pass on Steven's poisons, too, and I was like, oh, yeah, these are matching, but I wound up finding one that at least is a little less sketchy. There was a page called How to Poison Your Fictional Character with facts about poison so that mystery authors could get it right. So that's a lot less sketchy than other sites I could have gone to right. check it out.
I am sure we are all on a number of watch lists.
Yeah.
The nature of being a game designer. One thing you did mention, a lot of the places we cut or explored and then pulled back was, you know, in the early stages when we were building the game, the first thing we were trying to do was build what we called the vertical slice. It was basically fighter, wizard, cleric, rogue, 1 to 20. That way we had enough of the game, the core of the game, that way we could play it from beginning to end. Not that we sat and played like a 6-month campaign or something, but just so that we could play random slices of it and make sure it worked across all levels of play. So in a lot of cases, we'd be like, oh, cool, I'm going to build more feats to make the fighter be able to do this or that. And you'd end up with a lot of them.
Yep.
And we ended up way deep down the rabbit hole. And that's where some of those shield feats came from initially. Right?
Oh, yeah.
We ended up with more than we needed. In the end, because it started edging out like, oh, well, I guess we can't have somebody who fights with a two-handed weapon effectively because we got nothing but shield feats.
Right.
I think at one point we had to kind of take an entire fighter build out just because we were out of space.
Yeah, which one did we...
No, I think we managed to keep them barely, but...
we had to trim from all of them to make it work.
The freehand fighter was constantly on the chopping block, and I was always like, I think we can keep the Freehand Fighter, but we were always not sure, and we managed to keep the Freehand Fighter.
Also, one of the things with doing books is you're never, until it hits layout and actually ends up on a page, you're not quite sure how much space it's going to take up. So that might have been one of those ones where it's like, we'll probably have to cut this, and then it laid out.
Yeah, it laid out much nicer than we thought. And so we managed to cut very little from the fighter, even though we thought we would have to. There was some that got added, like the order. So the opposite of the cutting room floor, the order of the leaf in the druid.
Oh yeah.
That there were three orders originally when Jason made the first orders, and we added the order of the leaf because the druid was over by a page, and we must end on spreads. We cannot end on pages, and we were not going to cut a page from it. It needed everything that it had, so we just added a new order and a bunch of new feats.
So here's one
right at the last minute.
Here's one where there's something kind of funny on the cutting room floor because we decided to have something take up more space, and that is cleric domains. Because our first drafts used the old domains pretty closely with a few adjustments, but they were kind of using the old domains. And kind of looking into it, it was like, well, there are all these kind of ways we could expand these, and we think this other scheme would work really well. And Mark did a lot of work on that on kind of the scheme that you see in the book, where there's a lot more kind of diverse and interesting kind of selection of domains, more closely based on the Pathfinder world rather than kind of the 3-5 list that we inherited for Pathfinder 1, primarily.
Yeah.
So, like, that whole thing was like, this is going to take a lot more space. So we had, like, a meeting with, like, James and Eric and everybody to make sure...
Moreland,
like, does this really fit the world the way we think it does, and are we willing to spend the space on it to do it? And by the end of the meeting, Eric's like, well, like, I think we all agree this is just way better. Why are we even having a meeting?
Yeah.
And then we said, well, are you willing to give us another signature on the book if we have to get this in? And Eric's like, we'll get you the pages. We need the new domains.
So, yeah, sometimes we can convince our publisher to give us what we want by showing him cool, shiny things. you know, in the very early days of the process, before some of the design work even really began, some of the questions we had to ask led to some things being put out of the book before we even really started. There are two huge things in this regard, and both are kind of fun stories. One is, do you guys remember a couple years back when we asked for a PFS census survey? You guys remember that? Remember when we did that? We were like, we want to know what kind of characters there are as a PFS census. Yeah, I wrote that survey because I wanted to know what you guys were playing. We were trying to get a sense of what the most popular classes were, what people were playing, and this was right in the middle of us doing very early design work. And we were like, well, we knew we wanted to add a class to the game, but we didn't know which one to add. Like, we could add the witch. Everybody likes the witch. We could add the alchemist. We could add the oracle. We could, like, a lot of those APG classes were all on the possibles list. And we were trying to figure out which one to add to the game. So we concocted this survey, which was useful to PFS. Make no mistake, it wasn't just a ruse. But I was like, how about if we do a survey for PFS? That way we learn what everyone's PFS character is. That'll at least tell us what people are playing based on what's popular. Well, that was a really interesting survey for a lot of reasons. That told us an awful lot about how PFS players play. And
you naughty kids.
Yeah, and that's not to say that's representative of everybody and everybody in their home games, but at least it's a slice. It's something we can look at. It's some data, which is better than just anecdotal data.
Sure, and since then, I think some other sites did their own surveys, and it got pretty similar on which classes were popular in our survey and the other surveys. So
when it all came down, when push came to shove, we were right in our guesses in that it did come down to the alchemist, the witch, and the oracle. Those were three rose to the top. And get you in just a second. And when we looked at all the data, the oracle, when it all settled out, the oracle and the alchemist were statistically tied. And this is across, like, mind you, I got like 7,000 or 8,000 characters entered. So I got a lot of data. And the alchemist and the oracle were basically at a statistical dead heat. Until I dug deeper into the numbers and realized, because they were all weighted by how many levels of that character existed in the game. And then I dug into it and realized that everyone only took two levels of Oracle and then bugged out of the damn class.
Or one, just for charisma instead of dexterity for all their stuff. And then they left and did some other proto-based class.
They would take one or two levels and that was it. And it was like, oh, all right. Well, I guess we'll do the Alchemist. And to be honest, we're thrilled with the result of that. We're really happy with the Alchemist and its addition to the game. But the Oracle nearly was the 12th class.
Yeah. The Alchemist also gave us the option to kind of put alchemy in the core and have it be different from the start and kind of a core part of the game.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The Alchemist kind of needed
to be earlier more for the reason Logan said, so that it could be included in the framework. The Oracle doesn't need it. It's easy enough to add the Oracle later on.
In retrospect, it was totally the right choice to make. And to be honest, with the change to the sorcerer and how the sorcerer now, depending on your bloodline, gets a different spell list, we kind of cover part of the Oracle niche already. So those who want to be a spontaneous divine caster, if that's the thing you really care about, you can now do that by playing a divine sorcerer. Right. Yeah.
And one of the funny things with that is like that came later. It wasn't really, honestly, it wasn't inspired by the Oracle at all.
No, it wasn't.
It was inspired by bloodlines. It was just like, why does the aberrant bloodline give you arcane spells? And so kind of like looking through it, it's like, what if we tried to just give you whatever spell is matched your bloodline? So we kind of
there was our Eureka moment in one of our meetings where we sat and we all just stared at each other and shook our heads. And then I ran off to tell Eric about it. And was like, what?
I was really worried about that.
Because the rest of the department wasn't going to buy it.
When I first proposed it, I thought you guys might not like it. And then I thought they weren't going to like it. I thought the fans weren't going to like it. But everyone's, for the most part, liked it so far. Yeah. It gives you more options. It fits with the bloodlines.
So I had a question in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering if that approach to surveying kind of skews the data in such a way, because maybe people select certain classes for Pathfinder Society because other classes that they want to play don't come online until later.
Sure. So the question is, does that type of survey skew the data? And you're right, it does. But I was able to weigh that out by part of the survey asked for how long you had been playing. So I used that, and I took people from one segment that had been playing for a long time and analyzed that data separately from all of the data of the people who had been playing for a short period of time or for how long they had been playing that character. So I based it on total number of levels. That way I could look at it without that level of bias. That helped a lot.
It was also like the difference was so drastic between those top ones and the other options.
Even the witch, was a lot lower than the alchemist and the oracle. The alchemist and the oracle actually beat several of the core classes on the survey. They were way up there, and all of Jason's variant analyses pushed the alchemist up above the oracle when he did those.
But the poor, poor cavalier.
Oh my gosh.
Not a lot of people play cavalier. He was really low on the list for a class from the
To be fair, that's partially Pathfinder Society, where fitting the horse into the dungeon is not always easy.
It's a role-playing game problem where people are like, hey guys, I brought my horse. And you're like, we're going on an underwater adventure. But my horse.
Nay.
Did you just say nay? Oh, Mark. All right.
So glad you invite me.
I'm glad you came. You are right. There's a danger in bias on that sort of stuff, but we're pretty good about parsing that stuff out. And we actually asked a couple questions very specifically. Once you guys actually get a chance to playtest this, we really do hope you will take our surveys that help us get some answers and feedback about how the game is actually playing. A lot of those, you'll dig into those, and I am not subtle on those at all. I'm asking very important questions. That way I can pivot the data and look at things from different angles, right? Oh, all the people playing Wizards really hated this encounter. Why is that?
All the people playing Wizards liked it when they got to rest between every fight for some reason.
What a surprise.
They didn't like it when they had to do a lot of fights in a row.
That's odd.
I'm thinking back to your wizard fighting all the monsters with spell resistance.
Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
It turned out well when you got dominated and hit all of us, though. We didn't have any spell resistance.
Yeah. That was my most successful round.
I wish I was
joking. It really was. I blew up the party real good.
We tweaked some monsters after that.
Another thing that falls into that same category. In the very early stages, we had Wayne in the office doing some concept art for cool new things to put in the game, new looks for monsters and stuff. We got a look from him of these really awesome orcs that were a little bit more bestial, right? They were definitely not. They were definitely moved away from Warcraft orcs, right? And they had some cool things about them. For several months, we were like, let's add orc to the game. And we have half elves and elves, so let's add orcs. Because we have half orcs, I mean, let's just add orc. Makes sense. And for quite some time, that was a very, very, very serious consideration. And then I was in a meeting, and I looked at everybody around the table, and I said, really? Really? We're the company that puts goblin on everything. And goblin isn't the race we're heading? And it just hit me. It was just like the absurdity of it all. We were all sitting there talking about how we could put orc in and what we could do. And this wasn't even a meeting I think you guys were in. I was in like nope. I was in like a meeting with the other managers, and I just stopped and went, "What are we doing? We literally are saying is put a goblin on it, right? You know, we just slap a goblin on everything."
And a goblin alchemist.
Yeah,
come exactly. on.
We've had people playing goblins every free RPG.
Yeah, right? I know. People have been playing goblins for years, and our orcs are interesting, but nobody's clamoring to play a Pathfinder orc.
I don't know. Mike at the office is. Mike always asks us to play an orc.
Well, no, but that's Mike. No. Nothing against Mike. So for the longest time, Orc was a ancestor that nearly made it into the game. Now, one of the things that's interesting is some of our earliest feedback was, why don't you put Orc in the game too? Kind of an interesting thought. How many people in this room, by show of hands, would actually like to see Orc added to the game as a core ancestry?
Wow. That's a high amount.
That's about half.
And we already have some Orc ancestry feats in there.
How many people would like to see Tengu added?
It's actually less than orc.
Yeah, that's
people like them some greenskins.
Yeah. Right. I think the Tengu are popular on the forums among a certain crowd.
Also, a lot of people who would raise their hands are over there playing.
Yeah. Everybody loves them some bird people. All right.
How about kobolds? All right.
Okay. Wow, orcs were the most in this particular focus group.
All right, now let's ask all the Starfinder races.
Yeah.
Wait, what about Asimar and... Tieflings.
We actually have a really interesting way that we think we're going to be able to approach that when we do get around to looking at that. If you've seen the way that the half-orc and half-elf works in the playtest rulebook, it's kind of a side branch of the human ancestry. We don't have to keep it there, though. We could just make you are half-elf just a thing that anybody can be based on...
Half-elf, half-goblin.
Half-elf, half-goblin.
You're right, let's not.
Yeah. Oh, I know my next character.
And family reunions are real awkward.
In Golarion, we don't really have half-elf, half-goblins normally, but it's very easy to use that half-elf feat if in your world you do. But in Golarion, we do, according to the Blood of Fiends and Blood of Angels, have Asimar and Tieflings who are descended from a fiend and an elf, or an angel and a gnome. And so if we make an ancestry feat that is capable of being taken by any ancestry that gives you the fiend blood or the celestial blood, suddenly we can actually really represent them. Because before, the way it was represented was, oh, yeah, you say that that's your thing, and maybe you're size small if you picked a small race and nothing else changed.
So, cutting room floor, things that we cut from the game, rather than the future ad.
Yeah, that's true. Did we cut anything else for space, or is it more
cut all the monsters.
Monsters, a lot of individual magic items. We moved the environment and traps sections to the monster book because we just ran out.
We ran out of pages. But it was that or cut the sorcerer. Yeah.
So you still do get those, but it's just in...
No.
There's also a lot of stuff that we didn't include. Like, speaking of the sorcerer, most of the bloodlines we didn't include just because we want to play test a few of them. See how the overall system works. So we do like two divine, two arcane, one.
It's a good representative sample. I'm weighing whether or not we need to add like six more for the final, or whether or not we can save them. I'm not 100% sure.
We probably need to add a few.
And we only have a third of the multi-class. Yeah. We only have the core four. So that's something that we, if you guys like it and we keep going with it, we need to add all the other ones into the core. That's not really optional.
Yeah. And for those of you who have flipped through the book, there was a little surprise Easter egg in those archetypes in there, in that our beloved Cavalier, who didn't end up on any of the list, is an archetype now. It's not a class.
And to be clear, that is for the playtest.
Yeah,
we're definitely gauging response on that and whether people are like, they want... Whether five people want Cavalier as a core class.
Yeah, those
but it's an archetype.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's interesting because it does open up. I mean, some of the stuff we're testing, right, you know, it's things that we were like, well, we could cut that. We don't need it. But we ended up keeping it just because it's a test of how we might do things in the future. There are some elements of this, like the pirate archetype, the Grey Maiden, the Cavalier. None of those are going to be in the final book. Those are going to get cut because they're better suited for a different book than this. But they're in here so that we can test how archetypes work. One of the things that we're really excited about being able to redesign a game from the ground up like this is that we can make all those systems that were kind of bolt on before native elements of the game.
Yep.
Right? Archetypes were never a thing that when, you know, I was working on Pathfinder the first time around that were a thing in my head at that point in time. We had alternate class features back from 3.5, but they weren't codified into kind of a structured package. And it wasn't until the advanced Player's Guide, those became a thing. So
and nearly accidentally.
Yeah, well...
Then they weren't codified as much in the Player's Guide.
When I got the turnovers from the authors, half of them were just lists of alternate class features.
Which is what we were asked for.
Yeah, which is actually what was ordered.
Yep.
But I think a couple of my freelancers, this guy included, wrote them as packages. And I was like, well, these have to go one way or the other. I can't have them be both. Because it was very jarring in one chapter to have half of them be, you know, just kind of a pick your own list. And it soon became apparent that the pick your own list was terribly imbalanced, right? And it's like, oh, trade out this class feature for that one. Well, that class feature is clearly better. So, you know, but with an archetype, I could say, well, you know, that you might get a better ability here, but, you know, I can balance that by giving you a less good ability in a different spot. That way the overall balance was maintained.
You also get to talk more about it, and you get to do a nice piece of art for it.
Right.
Yeah, that is very
nice. And it has a concept. It has a story in your head, whereas there's no story of the person who traded out trap finding for +5 to hit or something like that. That's just the story of optimization.
The story of the broken character. What I was getting at is that because it wasn't a native part of the system, some classes didn't play well with it. Right? They don't to this day. You don't see a lot of cleric archetypes because the cleric doesn't have a lot to trade out. They're mostly just spells. So, the new edition allows us to kind of, and with the archetypes that are in there, allows us to test a new way of doing things that's native, that everybody can access them equally. So that's kind of fun and exciting.
One of the other things that we ended up scaling back a lot, not cutting entirely, but we have the kind of the critical success, the critical failures being a bigger part of the game. So just in case anybody's not entirely familiar, if you beat a DC by 10, you critically succeed. If you fail by 10, you critically fail, and also critically succeed on a 20 still, critically fail on a 1 still. But we had some different implementations of that, particularly with spells, where you would have a spell that had a really big difference between each of those categories, and it was kind of more common. And we kind of scaled that back just for simplicity. So, like, for example, critically failing against a fire spell might set you on fire. But we found in play, if it's something like Fireball, and that happens, then not only are you tracking this damage step, but then you're also like, okay, these three monsters are also on fire, and this one is, you know, immune to fire or whatever it is, right? So it was just a little too
much.
It
was cool, but on the GM side, it became a nightmare to track. Because you had all these different effects, and the effects were not... The big thing to get across there is that the difference between like a failure and a critical failure wasn't just, oh, it's more of one thing. It's an entirely different thing. And all of a sudden, I have to track the state of each person who made the save individually. And it's really critical to remember. Like, so
yeah. Fireball was especially bad.
Fireball was burning, and lightning shocked you, which gave you some other things, and ice slowed you down, and it was thematic, but it turned out to be a problem for the area spells. Now, we kept some of that, like the Druid's Tempest Surge, since it's one target.
If it's one target.
As a sluggish condition.
One target, have a lot more flexibility with that.
But if it's area, and you have to track it on six different dudes, and...
There would be things like, you know, you do a fear effect to multiple people, and now you're tracking like durations for multiple enemies who have a debuff on them.
We almost got to the point that where for some of the damaging spells, we almost got to a point where we could codify something that was just like, make a standard saving throw. And the standard saving throw means critical success, you take nothing. Success, you take half. Fail, you take full. Critically fail, you take double.
And that's
just kind of the standard save.
It's something we might still implement. But yeah.
I want to do it if we can.
It would cut down on us having to repeat that over and over and over again.
The editors know to check for it, too. So they found a few where we missed one of those four categories. And they're like, is that intentional? And we're like, no, we wanted it to be the standard one.
So other things that ended up, death and dying. How many versions of that damn system do we have? At least four, five?
Some previous ones on the cutting room floor and future ones.
I think we had at least eight in total, four of which were at one point alive at the same time.
We actually had four in the office. Each one of us had our own favorite.
I still like mine.
Yeah, oh, I know. I don't think I know about how all of you were trying to weasel it through the office, too. It was funny. We all had our favorites, and everybody had their playtest scripts, and they'd all be like, see, this one's great, and they wouldn't show the other ones to their group.
They'd just be like,
oh, yeah, no, this one's really great, and all of a sudden I'd hear, you know, anecdotal stories. Oh, I played the Death and Dying. I really like this one. And I'm like, did you see any of them? Did you play with any of them? No, we were just playing with that one. Oh, okay.
I ran my group through all four of the different ones.
Of course.
Didn't even like mine the best.
And that's the thing, right? The rules for it have gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's one of those things where every time we design a system, it isn't quite meeting our expectations in one way, shape, or form, right? Because we want death and dying to be something that the moment somebody starts dying, everybody at the table has to stop and check what they were doing, right? They were like, oh, wait, can I do this? Or do I need to go save them from dying? Do I need to change the way I'm playing? Do we need to change the flow of combat because we're getting into trouble?
And dying has so many different masters it has to serve that finding something that will work for a lot of those is really hard. Yeah. And so what we have right now is like doing pretty well on several of those fronts, but it's also way too complicated. It has some certain problems.
It's better than negative hit points where at high levels you would just die 80% of the time because the damage you're taking is so much more than your con score. But that's not enough to recommend it
negative hit points has the really bad thing where it's like, I got healed up. I'm at 5 hit points. Oh, no.
Boom.
That's worse than being at negative 20 hit points.
A high-level character was far more in danger of dying at 2 hit points than -2 hit points. -2, at least the GM left you alone. At 2, the monster attacks you. Take 50. No.
I got a 50. My
mortal body feebly tries to take 50 damage.
Yeah. Enjoy my spleen. Well, and, you know, so not only were there negatives just had to go. That was one of the first things we knew had to go because it was always a really jargony problem part of the math down there of just being like, having to talk about how you the negatives.
Anytime you have to count negatives.
Yeah, oh, you continued descending. So, but the new system is one that we're at least partially satisfied with it now. It's mostly functional.
But it's still a problem area. The backside of it, once we're stable,
is really, really complicated.
We need to find some solutions for that.
It's got some terminology issues, like the term dying sounds like you're dying and you can have dying while being conscious. And that confuses people. So that's one we're still tinkering with quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh, we're all dying while being conscious.
That's true.
You need to have dying one all the time.
Thanks for that, Steven.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for that.
This has been Ennui with Pathfinder.
Another thing that we changed up was we kind of knew we wanted a little bit shorter skill list because there were a lot of things that kind of tended to fall in the same bucket anyway. Because if people are taking the skill, they're usually taking this skill as well. But we had a draft where we had boiled it down a little too far, where we had I think it was interaction.
Or influence.
Influence
instead
skill.
Of intimidation and diplomacy.
Yeah, so it was like, but we'd end up with like, well, this monster should be able to intimidate you, but it's not diplomatic, so it's weird that it is good at both of these things. So we had to kind of roll that one back a little bit. I think there was another skill or two that we had to kind of uncondense.
Yeah, there were the initial list had it down to like something like 14.
I think Survival was with nature, and that one was a little bit too much. But the main one was just every time we made monsters or PCs, we would like a troll. You don't want the troll to be like, ah, yes, good king, I am the troll. I would wish that you would pay this bridge toll and not listen to these adventurers. And then it's like, oh yeah, the troll's pretty persuasive. Yeah. I guess we're going to listen to him.
Yeah. Nature and Survival.
Mark, have you been reading the message boards again?
Anyway, my troll PC. We need trolls. Who wants trolls in the core rulebook? There we go. Every monster has fire now, sorry.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Nature and Survival was a similar thing where we'd have a monster, and it's like, yes, the grizzly bear should be pretty good at surviving in the wild, and also it can identify nature spells. Yeah, so that was kind of weird.
Only you can prevent forest fires by identifying fireball.
It can train other animals to be a friend.
Was it medicine in with...
Yeah, medicine was in Survival, too.
Yeah, that's
yeah, right, once yeah. we There's split out Survival from nature, we put medicine in it for a while, but then...
Then all of a sudden, anyone who's good at identifying a berry could also stitch up your organs. It was weird.
Including a grizzly bear. It can both rip out your organs and stitch up your organs.
Wow, it's got Battle Medic.
Battle Medic grizzly bear.
That's one of those things that's a really useful experiment to kind of see how far can we boil it down. And then do we need to kind of expand it back out? And, after we kind of made those changes, we didn't really have that same problem again.
Yeah.
Because most things, it's like thievery, containing, disabled device, and sleight of hand. It's like, most people who want one of those want the other. So
You can come up with something, but you don't feel that bad ever about the fact that you have them both. Because, you're a locksmith by trade, and you don't usually pick people's pockets, but... It still uses some of the same manual dexterity. It's not like a grizzly bear stitching you up or a troll being the best hobnobber at the king's ball.
Although that would work really well in like a Jack Vance Dying Earth thing. His monsters are extremely eloquent.
Hmm. Well, ours aren't. Sorry, Stephen.
Well, there you go. Now, Stephen, we can make the Vance setting by just recombining them
right,
back together.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so we got about 10 minutes left. Why don't we open it up for some questions, if folks have questions about the game, what didn't make it, what things you wish were in there, I guess, for the theme of this panel. We'll start over here.
Were there any Precious Mechanics babies that you just had to kill because they wouldn't work?
The question was there any Precious Mechanics that we had to kill because they wouldn't work? Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us lost one version of Death and Dying that we designed at least at one point in time.
Mine wasn't that precious.
Precious either.
Yeah. I still like mine.
Steven's was precious.
No.
Steven likes his still almost as much as all the rest of us hate it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't even remember what it was. There are a lot of things where we did a bunch of kind of R&D documents, and we kind of... Each of us kind of went through some subject that was dear to our hearts and kind of did kind of a breakdown of how we might do things with it. Like I had one on kind of story-based mechanics as a core part of the game and like, could that work? But most of those we never actually fully implemented into the rules. We kind of like brought it out, talked about it with other people, and then usually it's like, we can't quite do that for whatever reason. Or our own research was like, this is a terrible idea. So a lot of those is like, rather than fully implementing it and then having to pull it back, we could tell pretty early on it wasn't going to quite work.
Yep.
For me on that was Relics. I worked a long time on Relics, and then eventually, went through like three drafts, and then it was just like, there's no room for this.
Yeah, and Logan had the story element R&D that never made it in, and I had some R&D that was about like trying to figure out a way to get the six ability scores to be roughly evenly balanced, and there were some that went out to really crazy things I knew would never happen, like what if dexterity was two ability scores because it has two scores worth of stuff that it can do, or things up to that extreme and down to less extreme, and we could never really implement any of them.
And a lot of that stuff is like, you kind of know from the outset that those aren't going to be two ability scores,
sure.
But it's a really great thought experiment that'll guide other parts of the design later.
They were still two of the best ability scores in the game. Or at least agility was.
Over here.
Was there stuff that was like just a bridge too far that if you thought it might be cool, but fundamentally step you too far away from one point?
So I think a really good...
The question was there anything that we did that was just a bridge too far that we realized was like going beyond the pale and making the game something it wasn't?
I think one of the ones that we talked about just barely was, you know, doing 20 spell levels. Mm-hmm. Because we have level meaning one thing and we have level meaning another thing, and that can confuse people. And so we always get either rename spell level or have level be the same range for everything. And it's just doing 20 levels of spells is just too dense.
It's so tedious.
Yeah. You have to make really like minor splits, and it makes each kind of spell level less special.
Yeah.
So that's one of the ones that we kind of...
Yeah, it was like, where do you put Lightning Bolt? Is it a fifth level spell now? Is it sixth?
Yeah, you
is
could say fourth? Lightning Bolt is fifth, then Fireball is sixth because it's a bigger ball.
Sure. I guess. Yeah. I guess. But that's the problem.
You're splitting hairs.
Yep.
And then it's like, well, I guess I'll take this.
It also goes against the kind of grain of us not changing the story as much as we could. You know, that's a fundamental sort of a zeitgeist understanding of the way the game works. I have three that I always harp on about, and I also know that like I could probably never do it in Pathfinder. One is get rid of it or alignment, which we go, huh?
Well, we seriously considered
we
it.
We considered it, yeah. But there are things in the story that it doesn't work
yeah,
as well.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's one also we didn't remove it, but we did remove a lot of restriction on
that
it. That seemed kind of arbitrary.
Yeah. We've made it
the Monk and the Barbarian and...
We made it easier for you to remove alignment if you want to,
yes.
But we're not removing it.
Absolutely. I would love to rejigger the initiative system, but that's a bridge too far.
I mean, we did change the initiative system entirely.
Sure.
Determining initiative.
Determining.
But the sick.
But not a non-roll initiative.
Yeah, not a non-roll initiative.
Yeah.
And then get rid of experience points. But those are my like crazy sort of ideas that you couldn't do with.
I wanted to bring back weapon speeds.
Oh. No, I'm
yeah. Kidding. Yeah, and those last two categories are interesting, Stephen, because both of those we did make some really major changes.
No, we did make,
but we didn't.
And the systems
completely
are definitely
throw
metaphor.
Out the whole
right.
Yeah, it, which makes me happy. I'm like, well, you know, we can't go my crazy radical. Let's go over here. But the thought experiment of like, you know. Me or somebody else bringing it up and like what happens if we just dump this actually brought us to some really good places.
Yeah, yeah. And it means you can kind of do okay. What are the things that gives us, and are there some other ways we can try to get toward that without as big of a sea change?
Yep.
Right.
But experience points are still.
Were there any major changes you were considering like making to like a core class that were either going to like take something out or add something in that you decided to ditch at the very end?
This is another one where there are a lot that we didn't. Oh, sorry.
The question was: is there anything that we put in a class that we ended up taking out right at the last minute, or changing right towards the end of the design?
Not a whole lot.
I don't.
No,
think
not
so.
Really.
I think the biggest thing was that we had millions of conversations about in the office that the message boards had many. Conversations about as well was paladin alignment.
Yep,
that's one that is still not entirely settled because there is every single possible opinion on the topic of what a paladin's alignment restriction should be and whether there should be any and what that should mean.
And at Paizo, not just out in
people
the wild.
People can't agree what Batman's alignment is.
Yeah.
So
there's everything from there should be a paladin of every alignment to lawful good is the only option. Yeah.
And this is why alignment is dumb.
Was there any system that was just a ton of fun, but like absolutely didn't work in the game that you had to cut?
Were there any systems that were absolutely fun, but we had to cut?
Relics are definitely in that.
Yeah.
Relics were.
I don't know that there was anything that we were like, wow, this is really fun, but it doesn't work, so let's just cut it. I think instead, if we ran across a system that was really fun but wasn't working, we kept noodling around with it until we fixed it.
Yeah.
I'm.
You beat it until it's fun and working.
Yeah. I mean, there were elements of almost all the systems that when we first designed them were like, oh, okay, this works pretty good. Oh, wait, it doesn't work in this corner case.
Right.
Oh, wait, it doesn't quite work here. Okay, let's change around a couple things and see if we can't fix it.
That's one of the challenges with the Death and Dying system, too, is all those corner cases that you have to test over and over. Or stuff like stealth, where you have to try every single permutation of situation to see which ones work and which ones don't.
Yeah, that reminds me. We got a couple small pieces of errata we have to put.
Yeah, we have to put that stealth errata.
Back there.
Yeah, I guess my question, and this is kind of building off of that upgrade too far question, and it might be a little too broad for this, but are there things that you have cut or decided to leave out because you're kind of restricted to maybe evolving but still sticking to a lot of the sacred cows, and do you find yourself in instances with those sacred cows where you're just like, maybe we should just be making a different game?
So the question was, are there any sacred cows that kept us kind of from moving further?
And
had we gone further? Yeah, I think that's always a game of weighing the value of it from a kind of gamer zeitgeist versus, you know, how far we can push a thing, right? You know, when looking at a lot of this, like spells and magic items and things like that, I think we looked very hard at some of the ones that are considered classics and made sure that those felt the way they were supposed to feel. Like Magic Missile was a bit of a challenge until I don't even know who came up with the three action casting.
I did it in the early spell development phase.
Yeah, because you know it was like, well, it's too good, and then oh well, if you spend more actions on it, that's a better cost for benefit, and all of a sudden it all just kind of locked into place. But it's not the traditional spell, right? I mean, the traditional one was you get all the way up to five missiles. So it's not quite that, but we did keep the heart of the spell, right? You know, you're still firing missiles.
Yeah, it doesn't have a save or an attack roll.
Yeah, it doesn't have a save or attack roll. It still does the exact same damage you're used to, d4s plus one. We weren't going to change that. That's crazy talk.
Yeah. Whereas the heal spell, we did kind of just like...
Yeah,
does anybody really care that cure moderate wounds works exactly this way? And we're just kind of like, well, let's try this and have it work this way and it...
So in some cases we were willing to experiment, in other cases we weren't. That's kind of just the nature of the game.
Here's the big one. The thing we keep getting asked about, and the thing that would not actually be that hard, but is really just kind of a sacred cow, is getting rid of ability scores and just going to modifiers. That's one that people ask us all the time, is like, why do you still have the scores when the modifier is what matters? And the score does mean something in the playtest because it is going to affect how fast you can upgrade your modifier at a certain point, but that is one that is kind of hanging out because of legacy, and so that people can still roll their
stats. A lot of them are terminology and look, like just like that one, because a lot of times we needed to gauge how much benefit we could get for the game versus how much it takes people out of their comfort zone, because to be honest, the game is somewhere that people go to be comfortable and to enjoy and to experience. Another one is I really wanted to call every kind of thing that check, since check is the term for a d20 against the DC. So an attack check. Checks, not rolls or throws. But that we focus grouped it, and
people were very
upset with attack check and saving check. It just didn't sound right.
Yeah, but I'd just rather call them rolls. But then, you know, other people were all like, well, you do a damage roll, and so it's a slightly different roll.
It's one of those things where you can't force speech on people. There's only so much you can do before people revolt. Yeah.
So to answer your question about sometimes you wonder if you should just make another game, is some of us actually do that in our free time. To keep our sanity, and plus they're fun thought experiments and great sketch pads for, you know, what we end up doing in Pathfinder as well.
So, I'm afraid we are out of time. So I want to thank you guys all for coming. Hope you guys have a great Gen Con. And we will see you around the show. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.